This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, kicking nicotine. Former smoker Elizabeth Hansen Hoffman is our guest this afternoon. She started smoking when she was 13 years old. She smoked heavily for years. Despite pleas from her kids and medical advice to quit, she continued to smoke. She was hooked. Then, thanks to the 12-step method of recovery, she quit. She hasn't had a cigarette for more than 14 years. Dr. Hoffman is a clinical psychologist, and she conducts programs on smoking cessation. She and her son, Christopher, also a psychologist, have written a book to help people quit. Its title is Recovery from Smoking, Quitting with the 12-Step Process. The book is published by Hazelden Information and Educational Services. Listeners, if you want to quit smoking or if you know someone who is trying to quit, I encourage you to join the discussion this afternoon. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number to call is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Hoffman, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be talking to you.
Yeah. You started smoking when you were 13. How did you get started?
Well, you know, my mother was a psychologist, and she was very concerned about me passing through any sort of rebellious phase. So she said, if you decide you want to start smoking, then come to me and have your first cigarette with me, which I did, and she actually prepared me for feeling lightheaded and walked me through the steps of learning how to smoke and persevering, even though initially you feel sick to your stomach. It's very sad, actually. My mother, a psychologist, died at age 49 as a result of her smoking, and her father was also a psychologist who died at age 50 as a result of his smoking. So if you can believe it, I'm a third-generation psychologist, and today I'm 54 and very grateful not to be smoking.
Yeah. What advice do you have for parents of children who may be attracted to cigarettes or may have started to smoke?
Well, one of the things that we know from the research is that if an adolescent or child has parents who smoke, they are much more likely to start smoking. So my first advice would be to do what you can to stop smoking yourself. And the second piece of advice would be to alert your children to the dangers, but if they do start smoking, as many adolescents do, instead of having a very punitive attitude, I would recommend that they offer help if the adolescent wants to stop smoking and is unable to stop on his or her own. Just suggest that we can go for help the way you would if you had a virus or cold or had a dental problem.
Hmm. You note in your book, Recovery from Smoking, that your smoking scared your kids.
Oh, it did. It was very frightening to them. And what I did with them was to actually encourage them not to discuss it with me because, and this is something that addicts can certainly understand, I said, if I'm upset, I will just smoke more, which is an awful thing to say to a child. By the way, my children hated smoking and actually called each other cigarette when they were very young instead of some other dastardly name. And yet when each of them experimented and picked up a cigarette, they were hooked. And both of them fortunately have stopped smoking and are in recovery for nicotine. But I think it's very important to remember that the genetic predisposition is very strong. And so when children who have that predisposition pick up a cigarette, they're much more likely to get hooked, no matter what they have thought about their parents smoking. So just all the wise words of advice aside, there is a genetic component, and I think that's important for people to recognize.
Mm. How long did you smoke?
I smoked very heavily for 27 years.
Wow.
Which is a long time. That was from the time I was 13 years old. And I'm so grateful that I don't smoke today, but I also recognize that if I were to pick up a cigarette, I would be right back where I was about 13 or 14 years ago.
Mm. Former Surgeon General Koop has said that nicotine is as powerfully addicting as heroin and cocaine.
Exactly.
What makes nicotine so addictive?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we are starting to do more research on the neurochemistry involved and have a much better idea of what's involved now than we did, say, 10 or 20 years ago. Nicotine works directly on a brain chemical known as dopamine, which is a very powerfully reinforcing drug involved in addiction. And nicotine affects dopamine in very much the same way that cocaine affects dopamine. And we find that the relapse rates are worse for nicotine than they are for cocaine and other drugs.
Hmm. Had you tried quitting before you succeeded at quitting?
I did, actually. And even though, and this is embarrassing, even though I'm a psychologist who worked with addictions for many years, I just assumed that smoking was more a matter of willpower and I would simply need to stop, period. I didn't recognize that with a high relapse rates that stopping would be a process and that I would need the support of other people and would have to use not just my clinical skills on myself, but would have to use support systems from other people as well.
Yeah. How did you realize the 12-step process was the way to quit an addiction to nicotine?
Well, I had been looking at a number of the other programs which seemed to work fine for some people, just as some people can be social drinkers and some people can have a cookie or two without going on a binge. It did become increasingly more evident to me that since 12-step programs with ongoing support, they appear to work so much better for addictions than the other programs we have. That's what we're learning more and more each day. I just assumed that with the smoking, that might be helpful too. And by the way, I had tried just about every other way to stop, so this was one of the last things, and I'm very grateful that I started with this approach a number of years ago.
What had you tried?
Well, I tried acupuncture. I tried a lot of holistic remedies. I tried various potions and a number of other programs. You see, as an addict, I was very externally oriented, and I wanted something outside of me to get me to stop smoking. So I would go for hypnosis, or I would go for the newest treatment. I did chew nicotine gum and found that I would overdose on nicotine gum. I did stop one day at a time long before the patch was around, but I tried, I think, almost all of the other ways. And, of course, if I didn't have a program of recovery or didn't do my part to not, you know, buy a pack of cigarettes and smoke a cigarette, none of these things magically would work on me.
Yeah.
But being an addict, I sort of hoped that something would change me.
Yeah. Well, we're all interested in fixing things quickly.
We are, absolutely. Quick fix. And, you know, another thing that we're learning now is that people who are depressed have a much higher probability of relapsing. And I would be surprised if to learn that I was not a little depressed at the time. Especially women have higher rates of depression. And so if I were depressed and starting to think about stopping smoking, I would definitely seek help for my depression today.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we know that if people drink alcohol or take any other addictive medications, that they're less likely to be able to stop smoking. So we know from the research that that is one of the ways that we can help ourselves stop today.
Yeah. Back to these things that can... that are out there that people can take advantage of to help them stop smoking. What if they're used in conjunction with the 12-step process?
That can be extremely helpful. And actually, one of the medications that was used for depression very successfully for a number of years, Wellbutrin, was observed when smokers took it for depression to lower cravings and to make smoking cessation a great deal easier. And when this discovery happened, the manufacturer decided to introduce what is known as Zyban, which is something you've heard of, I'm sure. And it is identical to Wellbutrin, but it is in a sustained-release formula. And this has been very helpful for many smokers who are depressed but also have strong cigarette cravings. It's been very helpful to be used with 12-step programs and other programs. So that is very helpful. Some people, in conjunction with 12-step programs, do use nicotine replacement, although 12-step programs usually encourage total abstinence as the eventual goal, some people do use nicotine replacements such as the gum or the patch. We have inhalers and sprays, a number of ways of having another form of nicotine. Remember, it's not the nicotine that kills us. It's the drug delivery system of smoking. That's what kills us, not the drug.
Zyban.
Yes.
How long a course of treatment is that?
Well, we recommend that people, and please understand I'm a PhD, not an MD. I do not give medical advice specifically or prescribe medication. But when I work with patients, I recommend they speak with their doctors, and doctors who are following the literature recognize that it is helpful to start the Zyban several weeks before the cessation efforts are planned. And there are a variety of different reports regarding how long people should treat, the patient with Zyban. If the person is clinically depressed, it actually is a good idea to treat depression for perhaps a year after someone is symptom-free with antidepressants. We're finding that that does prevent relapse, so it's a decision that a patient makes with his or her doctor, but it's variable depending upon whether there's coexisting depression and a number of other factors.
What about hypnosis and acupuncture in conjunction with a recovery program?
That may be helpful. We don't have very strong research to demonstrate that that really has some demonstrated effectiveness, but everyone is different, and hypnosis can provide very helpful self-soothing techniques, and addicts have a very difficult time soothing themselves, so hypnosis can provide ways of calming, and acupuncture, I'm sure, has been helpful to a number of smokers also. But I just don't have the research base to demonstrate that.
Yeah. What about switching to cigarettes lower in tar?
Well, that's a form of controlled smoking, and that's the way that Smokeenders and a number of other programs have helped people fade. We call it nicotine fading. And again, the research is equivocal on this. If you were an alcoholic and wanting to stop drinking, so you decided not to drink vodka anymore, you were just going to have wine or a little bit of beer on occasion and sort of fade your alcohol that way, we've seen that that's not very effective. And I think that depending upon, and I don't mean to be so equivocal about this, but it all depends on the research that you look at. And we don't have some well-controlled studies to show that one method of nicotine fading works better than others. So I really can't say that that is successful, but I know it's a very popular method and has worked for a number of smokers.
Now, other than the things that we've just talked about, are there other things a smoker can do to reduce the symptoms of withdrawal?
Yes. One of the most important things is to look at the caffeine intake. You know, smokers usually use caffeine in the form of coffee or something else, and nicotine metabolizes caffeine. So when someone stops smoking, they lose that benefit of metabolizing caffeine, and as a result, the level of caffeine will build up in your bloodstream. And so within a number of days, you may have double the caffeine level in your bloodstream. And we all know if we were to have double the caffeine level in our bloodstreams, we might feel very nervous, we might be pacing and have frequent urination, we wouldn't be able to sleep. And if we're not careful, we'll attribute that to withdrawal symptoms from nicotine when in fact it's caffeine intoxication. So I recommend to patients that when they stop smoking, they cut their caffeine at least in half within the very first couple days. That really helps the, anxiety of early withdrawal. And by the way, when people stop smoking and have completed the cessation process, their level of anxiety actually goes down. So often we think that when you stop smoking, you become more nervous. And if you cut your caffeine, that simply isn't true.
Mm,
so that does help with the cessation process. to cut the caffeine at least in half during the early phases.
Yeah.
And learning how to self-soothe, as I said, learning meditation or just doing occasional deep breathing, relaxation, that can go a long way in terms of calming some of the early irritability. Drinking plenty of water is helpful, too. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you either. I was just going to note that in your book, you've got a lot of exercises for folks.
Yes.
And at the outset of all these exercises, you say, take a few deep breaths.
Oh, yes. And it's interesting because I emphasize that since most smokers inhale deeply and take deep breaths only when they're filling their lungs with smoke. And so to take a few deep breaths of fresh air actually slows our heart rate and it lowers our blood pressure. So, you know, in recovery, to continue to take deep breaths without inhaling the toxic smoke is a very important recovery tip, and I emphasize that again and again in the book. Thanks for pointing that out. It's a very important self-soothing technique.
Yeah. Back to the issue of caffeine, this is very interesting because smokers who have tried to quit, smokers who have quit, often talk about feeling really irritable.
Oh, yes. Well, you can imagine if you doubled your caffeine intake, you would be irritable, whether you're smoking or not. I certainly would be.
Yeah, so it's as simple as just not eliminating caffeine, but cutting back on it and being aware of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing to remember that I found very helpful is that when I stopped smoking, I actually stopped drinking coffee because as a smoker, I had paired the taste of coffee and the taste of cigarettes so many times that I was very used to that in combination. I switched to tea, so the taste of coffee was not a trigger for me to set me up for a craving.
Mm.
And when I switched to tea, I really started to recognize I could not drink as much caffeine as I used to because it made me nervous. It was long before we knew what the research was showing. Well, it was long before we showed it in the research. But I just realized I had to cut my caffeine or I was too nervous.
Yeah.
So it does make a big difference. Caffeine has a way of making us very irritable and increasing anxiety symptoms for smokers and non-smokers alike.
Also, it's, you know, it can be such a powerful cue for a cigarette.
It can indeed. Absolutely. And people in recovery with other addictions talk about the importance of avoiding people, places, and things that are associated with using our drug of choice. And it's very helpful also if you have a taste for a cigarette in your mouth, and you, even if you haven't smoked for some time, but your mouth tastes like it's time for a cigarette, to know that if you have a little bit of lemon juice in water, that can change the pH in your mouth immediately. And so the taste in your mouth is no longer a trigger. And people who are stopping smoking find that a very, very helpful strategy.
Hmm. How much lemon juice do you need in that water?
Just enough to flavor it. Some people like it stronger than others, but it really does make a big difference the next time someone is craving a cigarette and they actually have been through the physical withdrawal process. I think you'll find if you drink a little bit of lemon and water, it'll make a difference. And by the way, nicotine is out of your system within 3 to 5 days, so we're not talking about a long physical withdrawal process here.
Mm, okay. Now, we mentioned alcohol, or you mentioned alcohol a little while ago, and I think we should talk a little bit more about that.
Yes.
Do you have to give up going to your favorite pub? Do you have to quit drinking altogether, even if you're not a problem drinker or an alcoholic drinker?
You know, I think if you want to stop smoking one day at a time, it really does make sense for at least the first 6 months of the process of being abstinent from nicotine if you're able to abstain from alcohol. It doesn't mean that you can never drink again. It just means that not only is there a strong trigger in terms of smoking and drinking going together, but there probably is something that happens in terms of our brain chemistry where one will call for another. And we find that, now this is with alcoholics, and I know you're talking about people who are not, that when people stop smoking and drinking at the same time, they're much less likely to relapse with drinking. And when people are not drinking, whether they're alcoholic or not, we seem to hear reports that they're less likely to relapse with smoking. So I just would guard that early abstinence from smoking carefully for the first 6 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
Not forever, but just for a while.
Yeah. Well, let's say somebody is an alcoholic drinker and a heavy smoker.
Yes.
And they drink a lot of coffee.
Yes.
You're asking somebody to give up a whole lot of stuff there.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that if that person decides to go into an inpatient facility or do something on an outpatient basis, that they stop drinking first. And that, when I say first, that is the first priority if they're actively alcoholic. And if they're able to stop smoking at the same time, they will just feel a great deal more comfortable if they don't drink caffeine. And by the way, I work with the Caron Foundation, which is a treatment facility in Pennsylvania. We have an inpatient program to help people stop smoking, but we also do a lot of inpatient work with alcoholism and other drugs. And for people coming into our facility, if they choose to stop smoking, we help them, but many of them do not. However, they do stop caffeine when they come into the facility because it really makes withdrawal a great deal easier.
Mm.
So if you're going into treatment for alcoholism, chances are the treatment protocol will call for stopping caffeine, at least during early stages, because it really helps with the withdrawal process.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and this afternoon we're talking about kicking nicotine. Our guest is Elizabeth Hansen-Hoffman. She's a clinical psychologist. She is also a former smoker. She started smoking when she was 13 years old and smoked for a very long time and very heavily. She found that the 12-step method of recovery helped her quit. She hasn't had a cigarette for more than 14 years. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Hoffman and her son, Christopher, who is also a psychologist, have written a book to help people quit. The title, Recovery from Smoking, Quitting with the 12-Step Process. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Weight, that's a big issue for smokers.
It is.
Should a smoker who's quitting expect to gain weight?
You know, there are a number of ways that people approach the subject, and I would say most people do gain between 8 and 10 pounds when they stop smoking. Actually, someone who smokes cigarettes burns more calories when they're simply sitting in a chair than someone who does not. But the reason most people gain as much weight as they do is that they have an increased craving for sugars, and they actually eat more. And I weigh, when I stopped smoking, I weighed about 115. I still weigh about 115. But I was very afraid that I would gain weight. And I was amazed at the fact that my cravings increased for sweet things when I stopped smoking. What I was very happy to learn is that nicotine does affect insulin production. And it does take about 3 months for your insulin production to get back to your normal rate. However, while it is so erratic, if you drink fruit juice, eat fresh fruit, instead of refined sugars, it will be much, much easier not to gain weight, and you don't develop a whole series of eating habits that make it much more difficult to lose the weight when you decide to do that. So I gained about 8 pounds, which is pretty normal, and I was able to take that off with just normal lifestyle changes. But I think people need to recognize that it is natural to crave more sweets, and that we can pick up milkshakes or pies and cakes or we can have that craving satisfied with fresh fruit, and I would recommend the latter for obvious reasons.
Yeah. A friend of mine quit smoking recently, mm-hmm. and he did a couple of things. He wouldn't bring home cookies.
Good.
Or cakes. And the other thing he did was he started exercising more, walking in particular.
Great, great. That is so helpful. And you know, if you do have a little increase in depression when you start your smoking cessation or when you stop smoking, you'll find that walking is one of the best ways to treat a low level of depression that we know. So it helps with appetite, it speeds up metabolism, and it also gives us a little boost in terms of our endorphins. So increasing exercise and not bringing those things into the house is a great combination of strategy.
Hmm. You advise smokers to pick a quit day.
Some smokers feel much more comfortable picking a quit day. But my caution here is, if you relapse and pick up a cigarette, just recognize that the next 24 hours starts a brand new day. So, you know, we often will stop one day at a time. I personally did not tell anyone that I stopped smoking on the day that I stopped smoking, because I am unlike a number of people. When you sort of advertise it to the world, you feel more committed to maintain your word. I had tried and failed so many times that I just assumed that it was possible for me to fail again. So I would just say to my friends, I'm not smoking for right now. And that really is the way 12-step programs work, you know. We don't say, I will never have another cigarette or I will never have another drink. We say, for today, I'm not smoking. I may smoke again, but for today, I'm not smoking. The all-or-nothing thinking is something that often leads us to relapse, because we believe that if we pick up a drink or pick up a cigarette, why bother? You know, we're just right back in our addiction. So at least for me, I didn't have a quit date. And for me, I just said, I'm not smoking for now. And fortunately for me, which is quite a blessing, the for now went day after day and has been close to 14 years. But I know that all I need is one cigarette, and I'll be right back there.
Hmm. What are the signs of danger signs for relapse?
I think that getting overly confident, believing that you stopped before you could stop again. If we find ourselves being very perfectionistic, one of the things that we can do to really take care of ourselves if we see relapse warning signs is to focus on what I call physical, emotional, and spiritual self-care. And that means that we sort of go back to basics, making sure we're eating three meals a day, we're getting our rest, we're talking with other people to reduce our stress. So I think that a number of the relapse signals can be addressed with good physical, emotional, and spiritual self-care.
Mm. And that brings us to the 12-step program. How closely does the process for smokers mirror the steps of AA?
I think that you'll find with all 12-step programs that they use the basic 12-step structure, and it starts where it starts, of course, with the first step, which just means that at some point we need to recognize that we can't have just one. I can't have just one cigarette. An alcoholic can't have just one drink. And then we move into the second and third step, which says that we come to believe that something outside of ourselves can help us. It can be a belief in a higher power, you know, an anthropomorphized God. It can be a belief in the power of a support group. It can be in anything other than just our own set of skills at the moment. And if we believe that something can help us and then make a conscious effort to seek that help, those are the first three steps, basically. And the rest of the 12-step program has to do with looking at some of the personal characteristics that I might have that might lead me to relapse. Do I have to work on my level of impatience? Do I have to work on my tolerance for letting other people just be who they are and not being so rigid and judgmental? in 12-step programs, we call them character defects. In psychological terms, we have a lot of other names for them, but it is really focusing on some of the personal characteristics that keep us from delaying gratification and taking care of ourselves. So the rest of the 12 steps then go into a program of living that's not rigidly dictated, but is something that we can do with support of other recovering people, using a therapist if we choose, or just close friends to help and support our recovery.
Hmm. Are there nicotine anonymous groups out there?
There are nicotine anonymous groups, and there is a number in San Francisco that I'd be happy to give to your readers to call to find if there is a nicotine anonymous meeting close by. Would you like me to do that?
That would be terrific.
The area code is 415, and the number is 922-8575. And for people who are in other 12-step recovery programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, there are many of them, if you can find someone in your program who has used the 12 steps to stop smoking, and if there is no Nicotine Anonymous meeting in your area, you can either start your own, which is what I did, or you can use other recovering people to help with that process.
Hmm. Any tips for starting your own group?
Well, what I did was I called this phone number and I asked them to send me some materials for, I think they call it a starter kit, and it was a format for a meeting, and I contacted people in other 12-step programs who had 12-step experience, but were also recovering alcoholics or in recovery, and asked if they would be willing to meet with me just for a short period of time to get these meetings underway, and they did. And I had a phone list so I could call someone if I wanted to smoke and I could talk with them instead. Mm-hmm. And that's really how the support base is built. So if there is no meeting available in your area, you certainly may start one.
Yeah.
A lot of people do that and find that's a very successful part of their recovery.
Mm-hmm. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us.
Yes.
On line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I have a good suggestion for your guest and you. And when a person eats refined sugar, it attacks the bones the way it does the teeth. So the real cane sugar is in the health food store, and it's a dark brown the way it should have stayed that way, and it's a bigger grain, but it don't cause the craving as it does of the white sugar.
Well, that's interesting. I do know that refined sugar is much more likely to set up cravings, and if weight gain is a concern and having a well-balanced diet is a concern, then I think staying away from refined sugar is always a good idea. Mm. And I thank your caller for bringing that point up to us.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. As we talked about earlier, have a piece of fruit instead of a piece of cake.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dr. Elizabeth Hansen-Hoffman is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking with her about quitting smoking, recovery from smoking. That's the title of a book that she has authored with her son, Christopher Hoffman, Recovery from Smoking, Quitting with the 12-Step Process. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Other calls are welcome. Questions, comments in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Something that I was unaware of, I mean, we're pretty, I would guess that most of us, or perhaps more than most of us, are aware of 12 steps, the 12-step program. But I was unaware of the 12 promises.
Oh, yes. The 12 promises actually are somehow, they can be connected with the 12 steps. And the 12 promises really talk about the advantages that and the gifts that we get in 12-step recovery. And I think that's very important to note, because Actually, the first promise has to do with a promise of a new freedom and a new happiness. And that means that when we start to recognize that we're addicted and we stop trying to control our smoking or stop smoking just at certain times and think somehow that we can control this, when we really recognize that it is an addiction and abstinence is the goal, there is a freedom because we really do stop a lot of the struggle. And you're right, the 12 promises are very, very inspirational and helpful to all of us in the 12-step program.
Yeah. It's interesting to note that folks that have been in recovery for a number of years, that's what they report. They report feeling free and happy.
Exactly, exactly, because there is so much more to recovery than just abstaining from a chemical. I think that I would not have stayed in a program or probably not been able to abstain for an extended period of time if there weren't a lot of gifts from recovery in terms of feeling much more free and working on some of the other underlying issues. And just the fact that I don't take 480,000 drug hits a year if I smoke 2 packs a day, that's a lot of poisonous gas, primarily carbon monoxide, that I don't have in my body. And so physically, emotionally, and spiritually, there is a lot that comes from the stopping of the poison that we do to ourselves. Absolutely.
How quickly did you feel physically better after smoking?
Well, you know, actually, within the first 8 hours, the carbon monoxide decreases. And I don't think we recognize the effect of carbon monoxide on us. I know that when people, and some people actually, commit suicide by carbon monoxide poisoning. And one of the early symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning is to feel tired and get a headache. And I know when I was smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day, by 3 or 4 o'clock, I had a dull headache in the back of my head, and I was very, very tired. My body was heavy. My muscles sort of ached, and I had no idea how much of the time I was suffering from the effects of carbon monoxide poisoning. So within the first 24 hours, you really start to notice a difference. And when you wake up in the morning, you're not hungover. I didn't even know I felt hungover, but waking up, with carbon monoxide in your body is very different than waking up when you don't have poisonous gas. So it does make a huge difference, and I physically felt much, much better within the first few days.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller waits for us in Charleston on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
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 Hi. Over the last 4 months, I have drastically reduced how much I smoke. I'm one of the few people in the world. I started smoking when I was 28, and I'm 37 now. And I was monitoring the amount of nicotine I would take in a day, and I've gone from 40 to 50 milligrams down to about 2. And I feel much better, but I just don't want to let go of those last 2. And is cutting down before you quit a good idea?
Well, actually, if you are only taking in 2 milligrams of nicotine, what you're doing is you will really have a very much more reduced withdrawal process. So the physical withdrawal is a great deal easier. Tell me, why is it you're so concerned about letting go of that little bit of nicotine that you're still taking in?
I have a great deal of stress that's generated from my job, and it is just so comfortable to sit back at a break or at the end of the day and just to have that cigarette.
You know, it's interesting because when we smoke, we actually do increase our heart rate, which doesn't lower our stress, but there is something about, at least for me, and this may sound crazy, but the one thing that I missed about smoking long after I stopped was I miss the poisonous gas. There was something about inhaling that gas that made a huge difference. If you're just concerned about being without the nicotine, you could chew the nicotine gum or you could wear the patch. But there is something about inhaling that poisonous gas that we associate with relaxation And it is part of a romance that we have with the poisonous gas. So what you're saying to me, I've heard many, many times before, and I know it is a very serious concern about letting go of that poisonous gas.
Well, and I've looked at the patches in the gum, and there, you know, the gum is 2 milligrams per stick, and the patches are the smallest one I could find was 7 milligrams, and that to me would look like I'd be going backwards.
It certainly would in terms of the nicotine. And, you know, when you talk about needing to reduce your stress at the end of the day, what comes to mind immediately for me is I think it might be a lot more comfortable for you if you had some alternative strategies other than poisonous gas. And if you know that that's your goal to find those strategies, that may be something that would be real helpful for you during this period of time.
Well, that's kind of odd because some of the work I do work around poison gases, and that may be part of the stress there. But I appreciate it, and it's been an interesting show.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for calling. I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
The call this afternoon. You know, something else that I think happens to smokers is they get used to having that activity with the hands.
Oh, yes. Ritual is a very important part of what we do. And I found that when I stopped smoking, I actually bought these little balls of cedar, and I kept them in my car, and I like to rub them between my hands, and I like to put them up to my face and smell the smell of the fresh cedar. So sometimes substituting another ritual is a very helpful thing to do, because we tend to be very ritualized beings often, and there is a sense of security in having those little rituals associated with what we do. You're right on target about that.
Let's talk with another listener. On line one, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I quit. This is the second time I quit. I quit for 5 years and then started smoking again. And I quit this time. It'll be 4 months next week.
Great.
Yeah, so I'm feeling real good about that. One thing I wanted to say is pumpkin seeds are a great thing, because if you shell them, then you're playing around with them, so you get the hand thing going. And,
good point.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a snacky thing, so if you're at happy hour or whatever where you would normally smoke, you can do pumpkin seeds, and it's a whole lot better for you.
Great.
The other thing is I read a book, and it's called Smoking, The Artificial Passion by David Krogh, and that's K-R-O-G-H. I really recommend it to anybody who's interested in the chemistry involved in smoking, and also kind of the history and different cultural uses of tobacco. And it's just a real fascinating book. It's not moralistic. It's not preachy. But you find out a lot about what's going on in terms of body chemistry and that sort of many, many studies. He talks about many different studies. So I'd really recommend that. I have noticed that my metabolism rate is lower since quitting. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Is there anything to counteract or...
Well, I tell you, as I said, we do actually burn more calories at rest when we're smoking than when we're not. But usually people find if they just increase their exercise a little, like a walk around the block, that will increase your metabolism. So you don't need to make a huge effort to change your lifestyle, but exercise is a great way to increase your metabolism, and that will make a difference.
Okay. Second question. I really noticed the lack of concentration. Especially, it was especially pronounced when, you know, in those first weeks or whatever.
Of course.
That was a major concern to me. I teach, so you know, being able to lecture and do that kind of thing and maintain concentration was a real important thing.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about that, the lack of concentration?
Right. I'd be happy to. Actually, concentration problems are one of the symptoms of withdrawal that we notice. And again, just a little bit of exercise is very helpful for that. Doing some deep breathing is very helpful for that. And to recognize that that symptom is short-lived, does not last for an extended period of time, but it is actually a physical withdrawal symptom of smoking. And yet, overall, over time, your concentration will be much less impaired when you don't smoke, because our levels of nicotine, you know, increasing and dropping constantly, that affects our concentration when we are smoking, because every time we put a cigarette out, we actually go into a little bit of withdrawal until the next cigarette. So it is really helpful for sustained concentration over time to not smoke, but for the early stages of withdrawal, to increase your exercise a little bit will make a difference, and to know that this is a symptom that will pass.
Do you know how long it takes before you're, quote, back to normal levels of concentration or whatever?
A lot of people report that it takes up to a couple weeks, and when you talked about the pumpkin seeds, it made me think that blood sugar levels have a tremendous effect on our concentration. So eating a healthy diet and watching what we're doing with sugar and just a good self-care program will help that concentration level return very quickly. And you mentioned this was the second time that you had stopped smoking, and I'm glad you brought that up, because many people who quit on their own actually stop smoking for as many as 5 to 7 times before they stop smoking for good. And I just want to talk to your listeners who have made a number of attempts to tell you that it's a very normal thing to have periods of abstinence and then to return, and just to know that it's important to keep trying, and that you know, with that process you'll be able to sustain abstinence for longer periods of time.
Dr. Hoffman, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Welcome.
Elizabeth Hansen Hoffman. She's a clinical psychologist. She's a recovered nicotine addict. She is the author of Recovery from Smoking, Quitting with the 12-Step Process. The book is published by Hazelden Information and Educational Services.